All right, so today we're in Love and Torah part 13. Wow. All right. Part 13. Now, if you've missed the other 12 parts, just walk out now and don't turn off the computer. No, I'm kidding. You'll get enough out of today that it won't matter that you missed the other 12 parts, but you still need to go back and get caught up. But we are in part 13, and of course, we subtitled this, What's Love Got to Do With It? What's love got to do? Okay. We've done that like every week. That's fine. It doesn't get old. Yes, Rabbi, it does get old. Okay, never mind. All right, so a quick recap, because we haven't done this now for a week. We're looking at the two great commands. Okay, the two great commands were to love our Creator and to love each other, to make it simple, to paraphrase the deal, loving Elohim, loving your neighbor. We've been focusing up to this point still on the loving Elohim part, and we got into Psalm 119, because we know that David HaMelech, King David, David HaMelech, is a man after Yahweh's own heart, and we wanted to examine how that heart would be expressed towards Yahweh and why he would be referred that way. And he does have many verses that do emphasize the love towards Elohim and how it connects to Torah observance, his love of Torah and his love of Elohim and how those go together. Because what we've learned up to this point through the other 12 parts is that almost everywhere that loving him is concerned or brought up or talked about, observing the commandments is linked to all of that. Okay, we know and we've seen that many, many times. So we are up to verse 85 in Psalm 119. Okay, so we're going to begin here in verse 85, and then we'll see what we can learn and how we can glean into. So we're looking to see as we go through this, and a lot of you did the 119 challenge that we did a couple of weeks ago. Okay, so that 119 challenge and what you're doing today, the same thing in terms of looking to see if as you read David's words, can you feel the same way? Can you think the same way? Because I think the reason that we look at the way Yahweh looked at him, he said he's a man after Yahweh's own heart. I believe it's also because he had the mind that he also let be in him that was like the Almighty's mind. So like we have in Philippians 2:5, let this mind be in you that was in Messiah Yeshua. So it's how we think and how we feel. And you can see that all throughout Psalm 119. So when he says that he's a man after Yahweh's own heart, actually one of the translations for lev, for heart, really is mind. It's not just the emotions, but it's a thinking. Okay, it's a thinking part. Because otherwise we're just thinking about emotions. Our emotions are often mindless, okay? Or a lot of times when people are emotional, we say they're out of their mind. And so we want to understand that this is a consciously driven emotional space, an aware, thoughtful, emotional space. So David's heart is really as we examine how he thinks and how he felt through his mind process, his thinking process, his approach towards the Almighty and towards the instructions, the commandments, and the Torah that comes from the Almighty. Amen? All right, verse 85, the proud have dug pits for me, which is not according to your Torah. Okay, so the proud, now if we go back, and I'm not going to go back and try to find the verses where it says it, but we did talk about this last time, that we're talking about proud, he's often referring to those who should know better that don't know better. He's not just talking about those in the world who shouldn't know better, don't know anything. There are those that think that they understand and they know, and they're going to lay traps for me. They're going to set pits for me. They're going to dig holes for me to fall into. Hasatan, the opportunist, loves to utilize proud people to try to set traps for those that are trying to walk this out correctly. He said, the proud have dug pits for me, and that pits that are not according to the Torah. Now, we could read this one of two ways. Either they're digging the pits is against Torah, which, I mean, if you were to dig a hole that someone would fall into, that would be against Torah to do that, to cause somebody harm. But I think what he's trying to say, he said, they have dug pits for me because they've had things that are against Torah that they're trying to put forth in their pride. Okay, the proud have dug pits for me, which is not according to your Torah. All your commands, though, are trustworthy. And they have persecuted me with lies. Help me. And so their understanding of the world and of the Torah and of the Creator and all things, David gets persecuted. Any of you get persecuted because of your beliefs in the Creator and the Torah in the Messiah and how you observe things and keep things? Of course. So we have that in common with David HaMelech, King David. They almost made an end of me on earth, but I did not forsake your orders. See, he's connecting it to the orders, to the commands. So I believe it's reasonable to say that this is not just that they've almost made an end of me, like literally killed me, but they've pushed and they've prodded and they've tempted and they've set these traps and they've dug these pits to get me to not trust your orders. This is not just about physical protection here. He says, the proud have dug pits that are not according to your Torah. The commands, though, yet I understand, are trustworthy. They persecuted me with lies. In other words, they said, well, you're doing it wrong. That's not what Yahweh said. You don't need to be doing that stuff. How many of your friends have told you that you've fallen from grace and salvation because you're trying to keep the commandments? This is persecuting you with lies. You don't want to be falling for those traps or falling into those pits. He said, they've almost made an end of me on the earth, but I did not do what... How would there be an end of me? If I would have forsaken your commandments, if I would have forsaken your rulings, your orders. He said, I did not do that. I didn't fall for the lies. I didn't fall into the trap. I have not forsaken your orders. He says, revive me according to your kindness that I might guard the witnesses of your mouth. Revive me has to do with reinvigorate my confidence, my encouragement, my motivation, my drive. They have beaten on me and pressured me and tried to cause me to forsake. Basically, he's saying, they've worn me out. He's saying, revive me according to your kindness. Why? So I can have the strength to guard your witnesses, the witnesses of your mouth. Now, often we hear him say things like the voice, the word that's spoken, the mouth, because after all, the covenant, we did a teaching on that, if you remember, small one, 55 parts, right? And that teaching covered the idea of the covenant being that which comes out of his mouth, we agreed to obey and submit and do. So he's saying here, that I might guard the witnesses of your mouth. Give me the strength, revive me, invigorate me, give me encouragement so that I can covenant. Okay? Because a covenantal relationship is a loving relationship. If you love me, guard my commands. Because I love you, I'll give you everything that you ever could have desired. I'll keep you safe. I'll give you abundance. I'll give you, you'll be fertile. The ground will be fertile. You'll be fertile. You'll have children. You'll have food. You'll have abundance. You'll be safe. I love you. That's what you get. You love me. That's what I get. There is no separating love and the Torah in relationship to him and to each other. That's the way he designed it. And so King David is saying, look, give me a renewed energy and vigor so that I might obey and guard the witnesses of your mouth. Verse 89, forever, O Yahweh, your word stands firm in the heavens. Okay, remember, we touched on this a lot. We'll maybe go do a whole teaching that will deal with this at some point. The idea of the above versus the below, the heavens versus the earthly. Okay, the spiritual versus the fleshly. He's saying, forever, O Yahweh, your word stands firm in the heavens. But what does Yeshua tell us in the model prayer? That your word would be on earth like it is in heaven. So it's meant to be firm here in the below like it is in the above. On the earth like it is in the heavens. He says, forever, O Yahweh, your word stands firm in the heavens. Your trustworthiness is to all generations. You establish the earth and it stands. According to your right rulings, they have stood to this day, for all are your servants. Now, let's understand that he's trying to make a point. He's saying, I recognize this is part of what you need to get strong when you have weak moments, is you have to recognize his authority, his sovereignty, his plan. He says, I recognize while people are setting traps for me and they're digging pits for me and they're persecuting me, yet I recognize that forever, O Yahweh, your word stands in the heavens, and it's supposed to be the same down here. And I trust that you have a plan to establish that too. So he says, you are trustworthy to all generations. You establish the earth and it stands. Now, he didn't say you just created. He said you established the earth. So you're going to take it and make it into what you had designed it to be. You're going to cause or allow till ultimately it becomes what you had intended it to be, to establish it. You know, he says in Deuteronomy, when we read in we call this the Birkat HaMazon, the blessing after the meal. It says that he gave you the power to create wealth for what purpose? To establish his covenant. So we have the power to create wealth, and we use that wealth to establish, to use it to make what it was designed to be. So it's establishing here on the earth. And it stands. Now, according to your right rulings, they have stood to this day for all of your servants. Now, he's not saying we all are his servants or every human being is servants. He's saying these things that you have established serve you. All the things that you have made, the heavens, the earth, your orders, your right rulings, your Torah, these things, they have stood to this day. Not we, not people, no people in this discussion. These things have stood, for all of these things are your servants. They accomplish your desire. The heavens, the earth, the Torah. We get an opportunity to take that in and then be a part of establishing. But these things are at the moment his servants. Now, human beings also can be his servants, but that's a choice we have to make. He opens the eyes, opens the ears, calls, draws, whatever you want to use as your word for understanding that. And then we have a choice. The heavens don't have a choice. The earth doesn't have a choice. He establishes these things. We have a choice. Those things all serve him. The Torah, the word, the message, the instructions, the guidance all serve him. When he says, if you do, you'll be blessed, that serves him. If he says, if you don't, you'll be cursed, that still serves him. Because hopefully through the cursing, you get the wake-up call to get over to the other side where the blessing is. You shift from the disobedient side, you shift over to the obedient side. Okay? So all of your servants, verse 92, if your Torah had not been my delight, I would have perished in my affliction. This is important for all of you that are dealing with, we'll call it psycho-emotional issues of negative, like depression, anxiety, okay, insecurity. Very common. Okay, not picking on anybody who has these things. As a matter of fact, it's rampant. Like most people have some level of these things. So what is David saying? He's saying, if I had not delighted in your Torah, delighted in all the things you said. In other words, I took joy and pleasure knowing you have a plan, knowing you're in control, knowing you have it all in order, ultimately, even though it's allowed to go in different directions from time to time, but ultimately it all serves your purpose. If I had not delighted in all of that, I would have been depressed, I would have perished, I would have been insecure, I would have had all of those problems. Because listen to all of the things that he says throughout this. You hear his moments. They're persecuting me. They're threatening me. They're doing this. But I delight in your Torah. And had I not delighted in your Torah, that could have owned me. It could have overwhelmed me. I could have perished. And by perished, it doesn't necessarily mean just, I literally could have died. I could have gone away that would have led to perishing. Which, by the way, that's the result of breaking covenant. That's the result of rejecting the Almighty, perishing. The result is not torture forever. The result is not some other thing that, you know, Dante or the Catholic Church made up. The result is perishing. He said, if I had not, now how do you not perish? You delight in his Torah. You take joy in his Torah. He said, if your Torah had not been my delight, oh man, my life is really rough right now and I'm miserable and man, everything's going wrong and people are beating on me and you know nothing seems to be going right. Oh, wait a minute. But all things work to the good. But wait a minute. Yah's in control. But wait a minute. He's got a plan all the way to a new earth and a new heaven. And he's got a plan to wipe away every tear. I'm okay. I can be okay, even though all this stuff is happening. Oh, wait a minute. In his Torah, he said all this stuff would happen. I could take comfort in that. It's happening according to what he said. Awesome. Let the Torah be your delight so that you don't perish in your affliction. By the way, he didn't say, if the Torah had not been my delight, I would have had affliction. He said, I have affliction. Delighting in the Torah, you notice, did not prevent the affliction. Delighting in the Torah did not prevent the affliction. He still had affliction. He said, but had I not had that love, that joy, that delight in your Torah, the affliction would have killed me. I would have been destroyed by that place, physically and emotionally. And then you could add to that spiritually, all right? He says, let me never forget your orders, for by them you have given me life. We see this over and over again throughout the Tanakh. You don't see this in the way mainstream Christianity teaches you the Pauline writings, but you see it in Paul if you know what to look for. But you see this absolutely straightforward everywhere in the Tanakh, that it's Torah observance that gives you life, leads to life and life more abundantly. I lay before you life and death, Moses says. Choose life. He says that I've given you the word and all the instructions of Yah, which are for your good. Look, even when they asked Yeshua himself, Master, good teacher, what do I need to do to have eternal life? And what was his answer? Keep the commandments. Of course, that was too simple an answer for the person. So he said, well, which ones? I don't know if he was trying to just ask the question because he didn't know, which I doubt very much because he's kept them, he said, since his youth, but because he may have been trying to wonder, is there only certain ones I need to do? Is there any ones I don't need to do? I mean, this is always human beings' way of looking at things. I want to do the least possible to get in by the skin of my teeth. This is the way most people want to interpret in Matthew when he says that, you know, the greatest in the kingdoms are those teaching to do the commandments, and the least in the kingdom are those teaching to break it. But then in your mind, you're thinking that means they're still in. But you don't understand that verse at all. He's saying those in the kingdom will be talking about those who taught to keep the commandments and say those are people that were great. Those are the highest level of people. People that walked it out. By the way, by teach doesn't mean sitting down with a student and teaching necessarily. Your life is a teaching. You learned so much from your parents without them saying anything, just watching them live. You learned, whether good or bad. You learned so much from your siblings, especially if you had older ones, whether good or bad, by watching their lives. You learned from your friends and others by watching their lives. But those teaching to break, those in the kingdom were referred to as the least of people. Not the least in the kingdom. They're not going to be in the kingdom. See, but if you don't know that those breaking commandments and teaching others to break them are not going to be there, you can't even understand what Yeshua was talking about in that verse. You can't understand that. This is where we struggle because we're given incomplete, on purpose, I believe, incomplete information. We're given partial understanding. We're not given full context. That's why so many people can read Galatians or Ephesians or Colossians, Philippians, any of Paul's letters, Romans, etc., and get a wrong understanding, because if you don't have a proper context as to know what he cannot be saying, then how in the world can you understand what he is saying? Because you have to have a context to fit him in. If you have a proper context and grounding in mathematics, just keep it simple, where you learned that 2 + 2 = 4. And you learned that 3 × 3 = 9. You learned your basic tables, addition, subtraction, multiplication. You can't all of a sudden show up in algebra and find out, no, 2 + 2 = 5. If that's happening and some math genius is teaching it, you sit there going, no, that's not possible. Because, see, I already know that 2 + 2 = 4, not 5. So you have to know and have framework. So when we're examining people teaching, when we're reading letters and writings, we have to understand what did the source authority say is and is not. Then we know what someone's saying, whether it can be right or wrong, based on it matching up with what is or is not true. And so when Yeshua says keeping commandments gives you life, and Moses said the same thing, and everywhere else it says the same thing, no problems there. When people claim Paul is saying that the law has been nailed to the cross and done away with and it was against you and it was awful and it was, you know, the law of sin and death and all these wrong things that he really wasn't saying, if you don't understand that he cannot be saying that, if he is, he's a heretic by the definition of heresy. But if you understand when he's talking about the laws raging in his members, the law of sin and death, you know what that is? And I've talked about this in other teachings. That's your understanding of right and wrong. Because your understanding is going to lead you to sin and death. The Torah is not the law that leads to sin and death. It's the one that defines what is sin and what leads to death and what leads to life. And Paul tries to explain it to you. He says, without the law, I would not know sin. I wouldn't know what is sin and what is not sin. I would not know where the lines are that when we use the word trespass, it means you've crossed a line or a boundary. I love that way of describing this. As opposed to right and wrong, sin and righteousness, I like the idea of trespass. You've crossed a boundary that you're not supposed to cross. That's what sin is. You've stepped over a line. And everybody knows what that's like when you're having a personal relationship, when someone has crossed a line with you. They've disrespected a boundary with you. A lot of you have had some horrible experiences where boundaries have been crossed and ignored. And you know that's sin. Not sin the way maybe he defines it, but sin meaning if you are in charge, that's sin against you. You trespassed. You violated my boundaries. Emotionally, physically, whatever it was. Well, Yahweh tells you what his boundaries are. And when you cross them, that is sin. That's trespassing. Stepping where you do not belong. We have a real hard time with boundaries. It's a disrespect of the vertical alignment. It's a disrespect of the word as given as to saying, this is clean, this is unclean, this is right, this is wrong. Do this, don't do that. Those are all boundaries. You're being given a parameters and understanding. This is the place and space that it's safe for you to dwell in and work, walk, play, love, whatever you're going to do in this space. Outside of this space, it's not safe. Children will bang up against and do everything they can to figure out where the walls are. Okay? You put them in a little room, they handle a certain way in a little room. You put them in a giant room, they're going to run around and run around until they figure out where the boundaries are. They're going to explore it. They're going to figure it out. You ever wonder why children are less active in a small space? Because they've already can see where the boundaries are. You put them in a big space, they're going to go and explore out and figure out how much can I do in this bigger space. We're human. We want to know where the walls are. Where are the boundaries? Are they real? Are they imagined? Do we believe him when he says there are walls? Because guess what? You don't literally walk up to it and go into that wall. You don't bang into a wall. Although life, he allows to happen when the blessings and the cursings, where then all of a sudden, almost not immediately, that's the problem because it's not immediate, a consequence comes of your behavior and you may or may not connect it correctly to the trespass. But you're trespassing. And he says here, David's talking about in verse 93, he says, let me never forget the boundaries you set, the instructions you give, your orders, because by them you have given me life. I know how to live. I know what brings blessing. I know what brings cursing. I know how to choose what brings blessing and what that I can make better choices not to choose what brings cursing. You know, a lot of you are sitting there going, oh man, I did all these things in my life, but I didn't know. It's okay. Aren't you glad you know now? I mean, that's kind of what David's telling us here too. Stop worrying about, let go of it, release it. Stop really beating yourself up about what you did not know. What are you doing now? What choices are you making now that you do know? Well, but I'm still suffering the consequences of the dumb things I did. Well, that's true. That may absolutely be true. You're suffering still consequences of what you did. But aren't you glad that you're not doing it anymore? At least you shouldn't be doing it anymore now that you know better. And there's things that you weren't doing that now you realize you're supposed to be doing. And now you can do it better. And when you mess up and fall short, you can repent. You can make teshuvah. You can turn around, get back on the path. He says that you need to delight or you'll perish. You need to not forget the orders because they give you life. Verse 94, I am yours. Let's just stop right there. That's a big problem for a lot of us. You like the idea that you're his. You want to believe it, but are you able to truly release all that stuff that holds you back from truly allowing yourself to be his? Because to say, I am yours, you know, I'm going to use an analogy that most of you probably have had this experience. If you've ever held a baby, okay, and you know the difference between when that baby's awake and when they finally let go, they feel heavier. They feel different. You can feel them relax. They let go. When you're sitting there with them on the rocking chair, whatever you're doing, you're trying to put them to bed, and they're kind of eyes closed and they're awake, but they're not awake. But you know that moment when they've let go, it feels different. There's a relaxing release. You all know what I'm talking about. That's what you need for verse 94. You need to get to the place where you can let go of everything and just say, I am yours. See, a baby's able to do that because at that moment they feel completely and utterly safe, protected, at peace, no concerns, no fears. They can let go. Some of us really have a hard time sleeping because we have so much going on emotionally that we have a hard time letting it go. And then you never have the peace. But can you truly relax? Some of you are thinking, I don't even know what that means. What do you mean relax? How can I relax with all this stuff happening all the time? I don't know. You can if you realize you're his. Then you can let it all go. I'm yours. He says, I am yours, save me. For I have sought your orders. So he's reminding, says, you have said that deliverance comes out of seeking you, trying to do things your way, focusing on you, submitting to you. He says, I'm yours. Now, bear in mind, this now flows after where we started, where he talks about them digging pits, them lying and using misdirection, misrepresentation to try to lead him astray. He says, no. I am yours. I guard your orders. I am yours. I'm not going to perish for my affliction. I am yours. I know you're going to deliver me. I am yours. You don't have to worry about me going astray. I am yours, mind, body, spirit, etc. I am yours. Nothing can pull me away. By the way, you're supposed to do that when you go under the chuppah and get married. But you know what? You don't know each other well enough to do that, probably, most of you, when you did that. And you weren't ready to give yourself fully. Oh, you might have been willing to give yourself physically and maybe somewhat emotionally, but not fully. You're still holding on to those sovereignties and those other issues. Because part of the I am yours is that you are mine. And Yahweh already starts off with that default. All are his. There is no question. See, if I'm going to marry you, you have to wonder, is he going to treat me like I'm his? Or am I going to treat him like he's mine? See, with Yahweh, you don't have to wonder about his side of it. You are his. I mean, it's not debatable. There's nothing you had to do to make that happen. By default, everything is his. Now, what are you going to do on your side? Are you going to do this part? David going, I am yours. He's also saying, you are mine from the perspective of what you have given me, I cherish and appreciate, and I'm going to do what you want me to do with that. I'm going to delight in what you've given me. I'm going to appreciate what you've given me because I am yours. Not you are mine, like we may have the mainstream of Christianity, somebody wants to make Messiah into the genie you can rub and he gives you whatever you want, okay? Okay, there's that idea that, well, you know, you need to come up. This is very big now on the TV with all the things going on and the negative, you know, state of the world. You know, people trying to get everybody to give themselves to, you know who I'm talking about. Come up and make that, you know, that Romans Road confession. Make that confession. You need to, and what do they always say in that? You need to claim him as your personal Messiah. And you know you've heard me say this. If you haven't, then it's good you're hearing it for the first time. He's not your personal anything. You belong to him. He paid for you. You were bought with a price, not him. Okay? Now, you can have an intimate relationship, but he is not yours. You are his. Okay, David doesn't say, you are mine. He says, I am yours. I am yours. Save me. Deliver me. In the vertical alignment, I know we talk about this, I don't know, occasionally. Since we haven't talked about it in 5 minutes, let's go ahead and talk about it. In the vertical alignment, okay, the one above has the responsibility of providing the one below with safety, provision, protection, all like the same thing that Torah is supposed to do, right? Bless you, keep you safe, help you transform. Read what it says in some of the writings of the apostles when it talks about, I think it was Peter was talking about husbands and wives. Well, husbands are there to help the wife to grow into the fullness of what she's supposed to be. The provision comes from the one above to the one below. The one below has to be able to say to the one above, I am yours. This works with discipleship too. The disciples had to look at Yeshua and say, we are yours, mold us into whatever. That's the whole idea of the master potter and the clay. The one above has to be trustworthy to do the keeping safe and providing. As a mother, your children expect you to do that. You're above, they're below in the vertical alignment there. The children expect you to provide and keep them safe. As a wife, you expect your husband to provide and keep you safe. The husband should be in a vertical alignment and have somebody above that. There needs to be. And by the way, men, your ladies will feel much more provided and safe if they know you are under somebody. I'm just telling you that right up front. You can clap for that. Oh, but I could take care of her myself. I don't need to. You are completely missing the boat. They will feel much better, not because they don't believe you can do it, but because that's the way they know you're supposed to do it. That in abundance of counsel and guidance and vertical alignment, they know you have all the tools necessary to keep them safe. But without that, you're missing some of the tools in your toolbox to keep them safe and to provide for them. So you want to make your ladies feel more safe, provided, and everything else? They will be so impressed to know that you're coming under a leader and that you're getting counsel and that you're submitting under an authority. Because then you're showing them that you're in the middle like everybody else instead of being sovereign into your own self, and then they don't trust that. Okay? Not that they don't trust you. It's just it's a nature thing. All of us need to ultimately... Maybe you weren't this way before, but when you came into alignment with Messiah and the Father, they felt better. Knowing, so if a wife has a husband and the husband's not in that covenantal space, they don't feel as safe and provided and secure, but when he comes under, they can take a deep breath. They feel better knowing that that alignment has been established correctly. But there's other layers in between just the Father and the Son and you. And you want to bring those into play. You know, one of the reasons David struggled here is because he didn't have a natural person to be under. It's harder for the leader at the top. Well, he had Nathan for a period, okay? But the prophet wasn't always there. But that's where he, you know, whenever he wasn't, guess what? David went into some places he shouldn't be. Then Nathan had to come and say, excuse me. I think you messed up here. Now you brought all kinds of nonsense on yourself. You need to own it. Of course, what makes David so great is he owned it. He says, just as human as the rest of us, boy, because he messed up about as big as you can mess up. But he owned it. And he submitted to that authority. He didn't argue with Nathan, did he? Nope. And so we have that going on here. So David, you hear him in here, you go, man, but this is King David. But he had nobody else to go to. He's at the top. Who's he supposed to go to? And so here he is. Now bear in mind, remember, he's challenged because, well, you might say, well, why didn't he go to the high priest? Because the high priest has a different role. It's a temple role. He needed a Melchizedekian, which would have been like the prophet. He didn't need the high priest for this stuff. This stuff he needed a Melchizedekian, a Torah teaching authority like Nathan. The high priest is temple service and the application, everything related to that. The difference between Levitical and Melchizedekian. So sometimes you listen to him going, but why? Well, he's the king and he's this and he's that. Why does he? Because he has to talk. The only one he can talk to is Yahweh directly. What else has he got to do? Because some of you think, oh, well then, well, Rabbi, who are you under? I got it harder than all of you. I don't have that. Not that I wouldn't be willing to do it if there was one to do it with, but you understand what I'm saying? I'd love to be able to go to somebody directly. But you should love to do that too. And a lot of the men, the ladies, especially the single ladies, they get it. They come right away and they appreciate so much having a covering. Okay, and they'll come and they'll ask for that. And it brings them shalom. They can let go because now I'm in alignment and I'm covered. I'm safer. Now, of course, they've been in other situations where they tried to do that and they weren't safe. Now, through vetting, hopefully they can find the right structure. And when you find the right structure, you will have that piece that you need. All right? And this all comes from what? Vertical alignment within covenant. Because if that leadership isn't covenanted, in other words, submitted to the word, loving and delighting in it, teaching it, walking in it, a living example. By the way, this doesn't mean they're perfect. It just means they're a living example. David wasn't perfect, but he's a living example. Wasn't a single person in the book that's perfect except one. But they're all good living examples of what to do and what not to do and the results that happen based on those choices. He says, I am yours. Save me, for I've sought your orders. The wrong have waited for me to destroy me. I understand your witnesses. Okay, so the wrong are waiting for what? That weak moment, the waiting for an opening. It says, the wrong have waited for me. Who's the most wrong of all the wrong? Hasatan. He's an opportunist. He utilizes people for that opportunity, but he's like a lion waiting to devour. So what does a lion do? It looks at the herd that's there of wildebeest or whatever, right? He's looking at the herd, and he's looking for a weak link, a weak spot, one that's weaker, one that's not paying attention, one that we're looking for an opening, one that somehow managed to get a little bit separated from the rest of them. Notice that that's the one they're looking for, is the one that got separated from the group, from the pack. Remember, there's safety in the unity, the echad, the coming together of the body. You're out there on your own, you're less safe. You're more susceptible to the enemy coming to devour. It says, the wrong have waited for me, and they're waiting for me to do something to provide an opening. That weak moment. But if you're delighting in the Torah, if you're not forgetting the orders, if you're seeking after the orders, verse 92, 93, 94, if you understand the witnesses, verse 95, I understand your witnesses. By the way, when he says that, he's not just saying I understand your Torah. I understand the witnesses. I understand what Adam did, Abraham did, Moses did. I understand all of these guys. I watched. I've heard the stories passed down through generations. I understand. These are the witnesses of your stuff, of how you interacted with people. I understand what results, what the fruit is of decisions that they made and why that fruit was there. I understand what happened and why it happened. So I understand your witnesses. So when he says, when the wrong are waiting for me, I've seen when the wrong wait and a person has a weak moment, what that turns into. David had that moment. He says, I've seen an end of all perfection. Your command is exceeding broad. So I've seen an end of all perfection. He says, I've seen what the end is of making the effort to have integrity. I think this is worded badly in the English. I've seen what that results, what integrity brings. It's not saying I've seen an end of all, like perfection ending, there's no perfection. I've seen the result of integrity. I've seen the end result. Where does it end? What does it lead to? He says, your command is exceedingly broad. In other words, it covers a wide spectrum of things. Not broad meaning it gives you a lot of latitude to get in trouble. Okay? He says, 97, oh, how I love. Now, here we go. Finally, the word love and Torah together. How I love your Torah. Oh, how I love your Torah. Now, bear in mind, he loves it because of everything he just said and how it plays out in his life and how it's there when otherwise he would have perished from affliction. He would have suffered and just inside he would have died. And then outside he would have done things to bring ultimate death. Oh, how I love your Torah. It is my study all day long. By the way, my study doesn't mean that he just sat around with a book or a scroll all day long. It means that all day long he's watching and observing how the Torah plays out in the world, in people's lives, in his own life. All day long, if you're with me and we're talking and experiencing things, you'll see me and hear me all day long point out, you see how this is exactly what Yeshua was talking about? You see, this is what Moses was talking about? You see, this is what Paul was talking about? You see what? That's what I do. And if you work here, you know, I do it all the time. Isn't that, see how this proves what the word said? This would happen. This is what the word's talking about. So when he says, I study all day long, I'm studying and observing how the Torah is playing out in the world, in my life, in other people's lives all day long. I have an awareness. Maybe that's what I wanted to make sure to talk about. All of what you're looking to do is going to be an impossible struggle without an awareness of where you're supposed to be doing. This is the idea of meditating on the word, praying always. What is there? Literally, I'm trying to pray, Father, that blah, blah. It's not moving your mouth and words coming out. That's not praying always. It's a vertical awareness. Some of you are thinking, I knew Rabbi prayed in tongues. That wasn't praying in tongues. Blah, 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 blah. I never mentioned Shananda or Shwanda or any of that other stuff, so it couldn't have been that, okay? She rode in on a Honda. She rode in on a Honda. Okay. Okay. Go let those Word of Faith guys know. See? It works. Okay. No, I'm saying is you don't need to be talking to pray always. Okay? What ultimately is prayer? A communication vertically, and by the way, in both directions, okay? Prayer is a awareness and connecting vertically. And that's simply a level of awareness you have to have. You need to always be aware that you are, you know, Big Brother's watching. This is not 1984. Big Brother has always been watching and having that awareness. That knowing that accessibility, you know, it's kind of like, I love the way Tevye does this in Fiddler on the Roof. He's by himself. He's talking to the creator. He's always having a conversation. He goes, I know you're busy, but you know, I got something to talk about. But that's kind of the whole point. Everything that's happening in his life, he always turns to a vertical conversation. Something happens. What am I going to tell my wife? Something happens. What am I going to do with my daughter? Something happens. But it's always not just, what am I? He's talking. He's saying, asking, what am I do now? Can I bend this far? Can I do this thing? Can I allow this thing? But it's an awareness, a vertical awareness. Okay, if you've not seen Fiddler on the Roof, go see it. Just beware that it's addictive. You'll see it once. You'll see it 100 times. It's just the way it is. Once you've seen it once, you like watch it every week for the next month. I mean, that's just the way it works. All right. Where am I now? Okay, 97. Okay. Oh, how I love your Torah. It is my study all day long. Now, bear in mind, think of the emotional behind that. He's saying, oh. You know what this is like? If I were a rich man, right? There's the part of that song, he says, I would study 7 hours every day, and that would be the greatest piece of the whole puzzle there. The greatest thing of all. If I was rich, I could study your word. And I want you to Imagine feeling like he was feeling at that moment. That's, I think, what David's talking about right here. Oh, how I love your law, your Torah, your instructions. Because here he's talking about I'd be rich and I'd have this big mansion and my wife would have servants and all these wonderful things. But ultimately, he's not that emotional about it. He's just having fun. He's dancing, he's singing, you know, doing all this stuff. But then he gets to the truth. He said, I'd have the time to study, which I don't have as a man who's a milkman and a farmer and what he had to do. I'd be able to study hours during the day, and that would be the sweetest, the greatest thing of all. And with modern technology and the way things are, you know, we don't have the burden that a lot of people do have when we used to be in the agricultural time. We can go to work, and when we come home, we're done. You have time. You can study the word. Aren't you glad he gave you Shabbat so that you have a day where you have no choice? You have nothing else to do but study the word and listen to someone speak it like I'm doing now, whatever, right? But you don't have other things distracting you. Give you an appreciation of Shabbat. Shabbat isn't something you have to do. It's something you get to do. If you can actually figure it out and understand, Shabbat is coming. You should never think that way. You should be like, Shabbat's tomorrow. Yay! Okay? Amen. And he says, look, because I love your Torah and I study it all day long, your commands make me wiser than my enemies, for it is ever before me. Now, bear in mind, he's not just talking about his enemies in general, but I think he's still talking about those that are trying to dig pits for him to fall into, those that are trying to lead him astray, those who are trying to take advantage because they're waiting on him to have a weak moment. He says, but my study of your word, he said, your commands, they make me wiser. Because Yahweh tells you that the fear of Yahweh is the beginning of wisdom. It's the beginning of understanding, beginning of knowledge. He says, they make me wiser than my enemies, but only, see, he didn't say it this way, but he did, because it's always in front of my eyes. It's always in front of me. I'm aware of it. If you study it and have no awareness of it after you put the book down, then it doesn't help you with anything. There's no wisdom gained from it. Information went in your head, and it's just sitting, rattling around, and they're doing nothing. Wisdom has to do with the application of information. You know, we've often talked about the idea that people say, well, knowledge is power. That's a lie. Knowledge has no power to it whatsoever. It's potential power. Okay? For knowledge to be power, it requires action. Applied knowledge is power. Okay, so he's saying, so think of applied knowledge as wisdom. So David's saying, I have wisdom because your instruction is always, right? When we talk about the Shema and the Vahafta, it's like frontlets before your eyes. It's bound on your hands. It has to do, look at the armor of Elohim. It's girded around my waist, right? The belt of truth, right? These things, the word, the truth, is always a part of what I'm doing, how I walk, how I do, how I think. It's in frontlets before my eyes. It's in the actions of my hands. It's all there. That's where the wisdom gets applied, or the knowledge gets applied, and that's what wisdom is. Okay, so you're told that even to lust after man, woman, doesn't matter, whichever side you're on that, that's already like breaking the commandment of committing adultery. Wisdom then dictates when you see and you're aware, you saw someone and it made you go, because you thought maybe they were attractive in some way. If it's as frontless before your eyes, there's a part of you that says, and that's all that thought needs to do. I now need to move on. That thought doesn't need to be another second. I need to now redirect my attention. It's totally normal to notice the first thought. Because maybe most cases you're not looking for that. You happen to be walking along or being somewhere. Somebody turns a corner and you go, ooh. Well, that's normal. Okay? All right. Now, some of you are practiced enough that no ooh comes out of your mouth. Although it can be written all over your face. Yeah. everybody who's listening to this on like podcasts, like, why are they laughing? Because I made that face. Okay. But like the joke I've told often, it's like the guy driving down the road, he gets to the red light and there's a beautiful woman on the corner, you know, and she's, you know, maybe it's springtime, she's got a beautiful spring dress on and just looking as lovely as can be. And of course, being a guy, he notices. Okay. Normal. Ladies, don't get mad at them for that because you notice good-looking guys too. That's normal. Now, if, however, you as the driver go around the block again to get a second look, or a third, or a fourth, or if you pull over to get a longer look, now we have a problem. Houston, we have a problem. Okay? But if the law is in front of your eyes, instead what you get is, danger, danger, Will Robinson, you know? I'm giving everybody all their 60s references that I can. Okay. All right? Because that will then get you to realize normal thought, last second it needs to have no more attention on it, move on. Okay? And that only can happen, he says, look, your commands make me wiser than them, my enemies, because they are ever before me. The enemy would like you to dwell on someone not your spouse. By the way, this could work in a different direction. You notice that this person of the opposite sex, who's not your spouse, is talking to you more gently, maybe. Or giving you more attention, maybe. Maybe it has nothing to do with looks. It's giving you something that you're not getting from your spouse that you've been desiring. That's, again, an opening for the enemy. And so, again, you have to say, warning, warning, danger. Instead of thinking, I like the way this feels. I'm going to make sure I'm available for more of that next time I come to work or show up at this store or wherever it is that you're running into this person. Because I like the way it feels. See, if you're letting feelings drive, look what happens. The mind goes, I don't care how it feels, this is wrong. End of story, move on. Oh, no, no, no. Don't go so fast as I grab the hold of the wheel. My emotions say, I like this. I'm going to spend a few more minutes here. This feels good. This is meeting an emotional need that I have. Of course, there really aren't anything called emotional needs. All emotional stuff are wants, but you might think it's an emotional need. I need to feel whatever it is this person's making me feel. No, you don't, but you want to. You want that feeling. You're not getting it from the other person, or maybe not often enough or at all. But you got to be careful, because if you are studying it all day long, if you're loving the Torah, if the commands are going to make you wiser, it only is going to be valuable if it's ever before me, if it's ever in front of your eyes. It's got to be in the front of your thoughts, awareness. That's what it means to have it in front of your eyes. Everything that's happening, everywhere you go, everything you're doing, the brain is going, is this appropriate according to the standard called the Torah? There has to be that little awareness, you know, checker at all times. You know, my phone is always aware of what time it is. I mean, every time I look at it, it knows. If I had a thermometer, it's always aware of the temperature. It's always keeping track of it. Actually, you have a thermometer in your body that's always keeping track of, do I need to put on a sweater? Don't I need to put on a sweater? Do I need to, maybe it's hot, I need to wear a short sleeve. I mean, there's an awareness. I need to turn on the AC, I need to turn on the heat. There is something always aware in your body of the temperature. There's also an awareness often of the time. Oh, wow, I forgot. I got to be somewhere. You have an awareness. Well, you need to have this always going measure. We call it, I don't know if it's a barometer or what you want to call it, but something that's measuring and aware all the time. Is the thing my mind and heart is dealing with now, my feelings and my thoughts, is it in line with the covenant? Is it in line with the Torah? Is it in line with what he says? You need to have something that's always on, vigilantly aware. Look, if I have a thermostat in my house, you know what it's always doing? It's okay, I set it for 71. It's always asking a question. If I have the air conditioning on, it's always asking, is it over 71? Nope, okay, we're good. Is it over 71? Nope, we're good. That's 24 hours a day, it's doing that. Every second. Is it over 71? Nope, we're good. Okay, oh, yep, turn on the air conditioning. Kick on the, okay, it's an awareness all the time. Where's yours? Are you always in an awareness? Is this appropriate? Do I need to make an adjustment? Am I doing what I'm supposed to do? Problem is, the thermostat only has one thing to pay attention to. Is the temperature at the where it's supposed to be? Do I need to turn on the heat or the air conditioning? What do I need to do to maintain the temperature? You've got to deal with this thing and that thing and this, right? You're going to eat. Now I got to worry about, not worry, but be aware. Is this appropriate to eat? I'm interacting with somebody. What, is this the appropriate way to interact with them? Should I even be interacting with this person? Maybe it's not even appropriate for me to interact with this person. Okay? You're very married and you're a guy and you're interacting with a single woman? That may not be appropriate under a lot of circumstances. Okay? Now, if that single woman happens to also be a vendor and coming to, you know, whatever they're doing, then and that's what you're interacting on that business, then that may be appropriate. What I'm saying is, you know, I've got a bunch of people out there, a lot of you guys, that have Facebook friends with a bunch of single women and you're married. Why? I don't understand that. Actually, I don't understand Facebook at all anyway because I don't use it. My wife comes to me all the time. Did you see this? Did you see that? I'm like, I haven't been on in a month. I'm only on when somebody wants me to see something. Did you see this post over here, this post over there? And it's not necessarily about other people. Maybe there was some interesting post or a nice meme or something put. But I don't have time for that. Okay? I can't even keep up with emails and everything else. And I've got some of you sending me Facebook messages. I haven't looked at my Facebook messages in like, I can't even tell you how long. So if you sent me Facebook messages, I apologize. I just don't have time. Okay? Same thing with emails. And that's, you know, I do apologize. But we have to be thinking about, this is what David is talking about. He says, I love you, and in my loving you, I know you want, as a way of expressing that love, my submission to your Torah, and I know in doing that, your love expressed back to me is that it keeps me safe, it delivers me from my enemies, it provides all the things that I want out of life, it actually brings me out from perishing, so I have the alternative, which is life. And this all comes back down to love. And how the Torah instructs us on how to express that and how to receive that, both from our Creator and from each other. And so he says, look, I love the Torah. I study it all day long. And that's, again, for all those who think, well, I got a job and I got two jobs. Pay attention during the day. You don't have to literally sit there and study it. But you know what? I bet you make time to watch the shows you want to watch. I bet you make time to play the games you want to play. I bet you make time. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, are you really using all the time you do have? And stop whining about, well, you know, if I could just do this, this, and this, then I'd have the time. But would you even use it anyway? Would you really? Because I'm telling you right now, there are people listening to me right now that are going to come here next week for Sukkot, and they will not make it through every morning for the Torah study. So talk's cheap. We did this every year. Every year, let's say, I'm going to just give you a number. We had 400 and something people last year. Now, not everybody, because of kids and helping and serving, were able to be at every study. But let's just say, for round numbers, we had 300 people at the first one. By the fifth day, because we had 5 days of this, out of 300, we probably had 75. I'm not exaggerating. I might be being generous, actually. If you were there, you know what I'm talking about. This happens every year. I have no idea what happened. Certain percentage of them may have gotten under the weather. That happens at every feast. You put a whole bunch of people together and, you know, stuff happens. Especially that time of year, even if it had nothing to do with people together, you get a cold, you get whatever's going on. We're not even talking about COVID stuff, just normal stuff. Allergies, colds, all those kind of things start to happen. But from 300 to 75, that doesn't happen just because of that. There are those of you that lose the stamina. He says, do not grow weary in well-doing. Oh, but I delight in his Torah and I want to study all day long. But we are going to study. Yeah, but we just finished Deuteronomy. So what? I don't get why that, how is that relevant? So what? I know we just finished Deuteronomy. It happens every year. We finish Deuteronomy, we go to Sukkot, and guess what we read? Deuteronomy. I promise and guarantee you, unless you have a problem in here, in your heart and in your head, every single class, when we read 4, 5, 6 chapters each day, Every day, you will learn something that either you didn't know or you'll be motivated to do something you knew that you weren't doing if you are open to receive. Even if you've done this with me every year, I promise you, because I will come up with, well, I shouldn't say me, he will give me some insight that I've never said before every time. Or help me package it in a way that maybe you never heard it that way before, but that's the way you needed to hear it to finally wake up. Because maybe I used a hammer, but you needed the screwdriver. Or maybe I used, you know, a wrench, but you needed, you know, whatever. I mean, there's different ways, different approaches. If you're a teacher, I don't mean like employed. I mean, if you actually, that's part of what you are. If you're a teacher, one of your gifts is likely to be the ability to find the approach that works with the student. When I sit down with my son, I'm going to maybe use a different approach than when I sit down with my daughter because they receive information differently and process differently. It's not one because one's the boy, one's the girl. I could have, if I had four boys or four girls, they'd each one still sometimes need a different slight approach for the light bulb to go on. It's not a one size fits all when people get concepts. Well, guess what? I can explain a Torah issue, and that's why sometimes you'll hear me explain it four different ways to make the same point. Like, I got it already. Well, maybe you got it on the first one, but the person next to you didn't get it to the third one. The first one didn't make any sense. Then the third one was like, oh, yeah, I get it. Okay? So are you going to have the stamina to show up every day? I mean, I'm 57 now. I'll be there every day. I've been there every day since the beginning. Even for those of you who know I'm not a morning person, I used to be there every day when it started at 9. Now, I may have still been wiping the stuff out of my eyes trying to wake up. Hadn't had breakfast yet. Well, because I didn't usually have breakfast till noon anyway. I just ate lunch with you guys, and it was my breakfast. I didn't care. But I got there, and trust me, I went to bed after all of you also every night. Okay? That's not to brag. I'm just saying, you're coming to this with almost none of the burdens, none of the responsibilities. You're going to, yes, try to serve in some capacity, but do you love this stuff enough and claim to want to study and everything else? Are you going to show up? It's amazing how very few people miss the meals. That doesn't seem to have a problem with attendance. Okay? And they'll show up to the picnic and the mikveh and all those fun things. And they'll show up to like a shofar class, something they think is fun. But are you going to show up to study the word, to discuss the word, to receive some of that information? And if you're new at all this, you're thinking, we're going to sit all morning and do nothing but read 5-6 chapters of Deuteronomy? Oh, yeah. Oh, you bet. There isn't anything better to do. Listen, when we first started doing this in 2000 or whatever, 99 or 2000, the first time that we did this as a host, like hosting the event, and we did Deuteronomy, we only blocked out an hour for it. And actually, I think it was Rabbi Tom that gave me the inspiration a few years back to, instead of stopping all the way along as we're reading it and making comments, he said, Rabbi, we're never going to get through. We never did get through the 5 chapters each day. He said, why don't we read the whole chapters first and then talk about it? Was that you? It was Rabbi Tom that said it to me about 6 years ago, okay? Because I felt like, you know, we'd read some of it and then we'd stop and talk and read some of it, stop and talk. But you know what? Then we couldn't get past anything. Those of you who know me understand completely. So now we read the whole 5 or 6 chapters, and then we take notes along the way, and then we talk about it. And guess what? We then realized we couldn't do that in an hour. And so we started blocking out the whole morning, from breakfast to lunch. And even then, it's not enough time. I'd have us do it all day. Why not? What's better than that? And there are people that'll come here saying, well, who are your speakers? Why do you want speakers? You're coming here for the assembling together of the body and for guidance from your teacher. Isn't that what we're here for? Okay, now if we have other teachers in our group, we'd have them speak, and we have in the past done that from time to time. Well, every now and then it goes sideways when we've done that, but that's happened. Most of you were not at that feast, but Rabbi Tom remembers, you know. But that's okay. We still give people an opportunity, but those are other teachers that are part of the organization, or at least they were at the time, all right? And that can happen, but you know, we should be here to study his word and to meet with him and to meet with each other. And so I want to expect fabulous attendance, not just to day one, but in day five. Because I've got it broken out that we're going to read, let's see, Deuteronomy on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. So that's 5 days. And I expect that by Friday, we still have 300. Unless, of course, you happen to have something that is a legitimate reason why, you know what I'm saying? Because that can happen, all right? But I expect we'll have an attrition rate that's very small. This is a marathon, it's not a sprint. And the really good stuff comes in those last day when we cover 29 and 30 and really, you know, we get into those last chapters, the blessings and cursings all the way to the end. That's the dynamite stuff. I mean, that's where we really get the halakhic stuff. You don't want to miss that and whatever you were supposed to get out of it. Amen? I think we need to end. I just went too long. Okay, let's go before the Father. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King. Father, we come before you and we are just trying to get our hearts right and focus correctly on you and our minds focused on you so that we can truly delight in your Torah, that it can be as frontless before our eyes, that it can be that which can make us wiser than any enemy that may try to derail what we're doing and what you're doing in us. Father, we want to thank you. In your love, you have given us your instruction. In your love, you have poured out in your mercy instructions and guidance for this world, for this life, to live in this space. You have told us where the boundaries are. You've given us your expectation in all relationships. For them to be successful, there's a requirement that there be a setting of expectation. We didn't really talk about that much today, but we should more. And in your expectation, in covenant, you expect us to trust you, to obey. And then we can then expect all other things will be handled and that we can have shalom, peace, and provision at all times. Oh, that we could all sound like David and say, oh, how I love your Torah. It is my study all day long. Father, we want to thank you. Be patient with us. Continue to do when it says here your Torah, if it had really been our delight, we would not perish, that it would encourage us and strengthen us and lift us up and give us the energy and the motivation to keep taking one more step forward. Knowing that that's what it's all about, the demonstration that we trust you and we'll do what you say. So, Father, we want to thank you. Praise you and submit ourselves to you in the name above all names, Yeshua our Messiah. Amen. Amen.